Welcome to Season 2 of Blazing Trails. This Salesforce podcast is back for another season of stories we've collected from our events around the globe. I'm Sabrina Barakzai, social and content marketer for Salesforce Strategic Events. We're sharing stories that reach beyond the tech industry. So no matter your career, location, or interests, we aim to curate a podcast that speaks to you. You will hear from inspirational speakers and conversations around game-changing innovations. Learn about a breadth of topics, from AI to the fourth industrial revolution to the fight for equal pay and so much more. True and unambiguous good in the world. Can AI do this? And if so, how? Dr. Vivian Ming, founder and chair of Socos Labs, takes a look at how new technologies are accelerating changes in the medical world. Hear examples of technology that's truly changing lives, inside and outside of hospitals and in the global refugee crisis. Last year at Dreamforce, Dr. Ming discussed how she is helping to develop AI for good. But these developments, of course, come with frightening and complex ethical questions. Hear how these important discoveries in AI are changing the medical landscape.
In my context, which is how do we develop machine learning and artificial intelligence that can truly unambiguously do good in the world? Not to belittle the importance of having technologies that can optimize your supply chain, that can help you target the right potential sales company, but there's something profound about being able to save a life that is, I will tell you, incredibly rewarding. And I want to focus on that. So instead of this provocative statement, I'm going to make another one. Technology must always challenge us. So when you turn it off, you're actually better than when you first turned it on. So what do I mean by that? Let me give you a negative example, and it's a fairly provocative one. So I'm a neuroscientist by training. One of the things we know is prophylactic against long-term cognitive decline, early dementia, is navigating through space. But none of us do it anymore. I don't. I open up my phone, I call up a map, it tells me where to go and how to get around traffic. I put a little thought into it, but not that much. I'm not a futurist, I don't typically make predictions and this sort of thing, but I'll make one here. 40 years from now, we will see a significant increase in the incidence of early onset dementia, specifically because of automated maps. And that should worry you, because it's a great technology. Who wouldn't want a map? I travel all around the world, and suddenly I'm a local everywhere. I managed to get the thing to work in Shenzhen. I don't know how. I got kicked off WeChat permanently within like an hour of landing in China. I don't know what I said, but that was then. But I could get Google Maps to work, and I could find my way around, and it was wonderful. But even though I'm better when I'm using it, I might actually be worse off when I finally turn it off. And this plays in, so I'm going to really briefly tell you about six little stories of things that I built. I'm actually going to start with a seventh, which was a prototype. We never actually built it out, but it gives you a sense of what I mean. So this was for Alzheimer's. So for a while, I've got in my office a mobile EEG, so brain waves, brain imaging, Google Glass. I had an early pair. In fact, I may even talk a little bit about it in one of these stories, an early pair of Google Glass pre-release to sort of explore things we could actually build with it. And I have some experience with hacking sort of the wearable equipment and putting it towards a purpose. And one of the things we thought about in a project with some postdocs at UC Berkeley was, what if someone had an early diagnosis of Alzheimer's? Very early on. And so we could go in them, and forgive me, this is the truth of very early technology, we make you look like just a fucking idiot. You know, we stick a wireless EEG and Google Glass and you roll the stuff, you're like a Borg. But what we start to do is build a model of who you are. So when I see someone and I process their face and I have an emotional reaction to them, we build a model of that. As I navigate through space and interactions with certain people in certain places produce reactions, we build a model of that. I'm not talking overly sophisticated. In many cases, the original prototype vision here was really straightforward, simple stuff. Simple. You know, 10 years before, impossible science fiction. wait 10 years and it's a dumb app on your phone. So in this case, though, the goal is as the disease progresses and you start to see that loss of function, what happens in that first moment when you don't recognize your own child? That terrible sense of the loss of self and a loss of independence. So it turns out, not with a mobile EEG, although I think we will get there someday, you can actually pick up on the neural signature of that memory failure before you're aware of it. And flash the name of your child in the heads-up screen on the Google Glass. Now, there's more sophisticated things you could do, but let's just start with the minimal. The MVP product here is, yeah, of course that's my son's name. And you don't experience the memory failure. We have no idea whether this sort of thing will actually help with the mortality and the progression of the disease. But imagine 5 years of your life having three of those where you get to be you. And we scaffold that and we give you the augmented intelligence rather than the artificial intelligence to be you for as long as possible. So, you know, the whole idea here is that it only turns on when you need it. It only turns on when it detects the memory failure. So much of what we're building today is intervening, it's substituting for what we can already do. Challenging technology shouldn't substitute. Challenging technology should make us better. So here are six little examples. Now, when I got Google Glass, I built a couple of things for it. One was a system for autistic kids. So we could look out across the audience and I could read your facial expressions and you could do all sorts of things with it. In fact, I learned how to do this in my undergraduate lab years and years ago. We were doing real-time lie detection for the CIA. So, you know, a little morally gray, but a fascinating project to work on. You know, 15 years ago when this was cutting-edge stuff. Now it turns out, like I said, it's a dumb little app on your phone. I actually mean that literally. My lab spun off as a startup and got bought by Apple. All the new Animoji stuff, the face modeling, that's my old lab. And, you know, we were envisioning, wow, if you could record the facial things, you don't have to send a video, you just send face coordinates, then you animate a little face on the other side, and they finally got the budget to build the damn thing. There's a great story behind this, but we have so little time. So another thing I built for Google Glass, in fact, I wore it for about 3 years, way longer than anyone at Google did. I mean, this was not a scorcher of a technology. And the reason was because they wanted to keep it lightweight and fun and social. And they didn't want to scare people by making them think that Google Glass was, you know, reading everyone's faces and doing lie detection and credit scores and pulling up your Ashley Madison account or something, which, I mean, I built for myself. But, you know, when you say no to technologies like that, you say no to superpowers. If you're autistic, reading a facial expression is a superpower. It's something that your biology doesn't give you for free. The standard technology for dealing with that today is cartoon faces on flashcards. That's really disappointing. So we built this thing, and it extracts what's called the facial action code, all the stuff we were doing in the lie detection. It infers the emotion, it writes it on the screen, and in real-time interactions, in social interactions with other people, these kids can learn how to read facial expressions. And not only can they learn them, but it turns out they learn a theory of mind, empathy. It increases their ability to understand why people do what they do. They preserve what's amazing about being different, but you scaffold them. You build this augmentive system that compensates for some of the things they're not as good at. Another thing we had for Google Glass is for this little kid in the corner with the goggles and the funny hat. So a panel of internationally renowned scientists was put together, determined him to be the cutest kid in the world. The fact that the panel was exclusively made up of his mom's is purely a coincidence. So this is my son, and 6 years ago, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And, you know, that was hard. The 4 days over Thanksgiving weekend that we spent at what is now Benioff UCSF Oakland Children's Hospital was not a fun 4 days. But we left as a whole family, and not every family there had that chance. So, perspective. What was shocking to me was a month later. My wife and I started collecting everything. We crashed Google Docs, everything he ate, to the gram, every activity level, his heart rate, did he have the sniffles, was he grouchy that morning, everything. Then we, before our first outpatient visit with his endocrinologist, a person I greatly respect and like, we emailed it to him. And they didn't really respond, so he thought, oh, they want a printout. So we show up with like an inch-thick stack of spreadsheet printout. They were angry with us for wasting their time. What am I supposed to do with this data? Which, but by the way, if during the course of your job you ever say, what am I supposed to do with that data, that job is not long for this world. That is the sort of thing that makes people like me salivate. Oh, I can automate that job away and make $1 billion. At least in theory, I haven't been smart enough to take the billion yet. But that very day, in my wild arrogance as a theoretical neuroscientist, I thought, I make models of the brain. Are you telling me diabetes is more complex than the brain? So we hacked all of his equipment, his insulin pump, his continuous glucose monitor, smartwatch. Turns out we broke several federal laws in doing so. I didn't realize that at the time. And instead of sending that data to some black box server at a corporate headquarters somewhere, which I guarantee you they were doing nothing with, I sent it to my server. And I built a model based on predictive coding in the retina to actually predict his blood glucose levels hours into the future. So no one else had done this. Why? Well, that's hard to say. I mean, certainly the machine learning was there to do it. But I think people looked at this and they thought, we understand diabetes and the dynamics of digestion, and there's nothing there that you could improve. So we built this thing, and it turns out it was able to predict hours into the future with a very high degree of accuracy whether his blood glucose levels would go high or low. I met President Obama at the White House wearing Google Glass. Secret Service wasn't thrilled. This is actually why I met him. That was the other choice besides kicking me out. So my first words to the President of the United States were, okay, Glass, take a picture. Which really did not improve his opinion of me. But the reason I was wearing them is my son was back here in San Francisco, and I was still getting real-time updates about whether his blood glucose levels were going high or low. And that was an incredible experience. I built a superpower. Of course I don't mind people calling me a glasshole. I'm a mom. That is powerful. Anyone would look like an idiot in exchange for knowing that their child was safe. And, you know, sometimes it's hard on my son. He's 10 now, and he doesn't get to eat everything he wants to eat. He doesn't always get to do the stuff the other kids get to do because all the adults are so scared of what might happen. And when it gets really hard, I let him know that one of the coolest. So we gave most of this is on here, we just gave away. So in this case, Eli Lilly, for example, is building a predictive artificial pancreas that in simulation works better than the real thing, which has some interesting ethical implications for anyone that has a family history of type 2 diabetes. But when my son is having a hard day, I remind him that because we went through this, millions of people will be alive, that he had a role in making the world a better place. Now, AI didn't figure highly in that story. I didn't describe to you the model we used in any real detail. It's just a tool. It's a tool that allows you to identify, to take a real human problem, identify a human solution, but then make it available to everyone. Actually, so there's over 1 million orphan refugees in refugee camps around the world. And the way at the time, 10 years ago, they were dealing with it was a book with 1 million photographs in it. So we built this thing. If you could get an iPad, it took about 3 minutes. You know, my niece looks a little bit more like this kid, a little more like this. If she's in a camp anywhere in the world, you found her. That's what AI can do. And again, I don't want to dismiss the importance of artificial intelligence for your businesses, but this is a transformative in the way we think about, should we allow these sorts of technologies to be out there and ubiquitous in the public? If you're scared about having ubiquitous face recognition technologies, that's perfectly fine. I shouldn't make that decision. We should. But we should do it knowing, therefore, that we won't have that technology available for those autistic kids. and we may not have it in the case of these orphans. And in fact, maybe what we really want to do is not say yes or no to any of these technologies, but really confront the complex ethics of these decisions and focus on the things that are actually going to make us better as people.
It's no secret that technology is a huge part of our everyday lives. We use apps and smartphones to track the weather, figure out when the next train is coming, and read up on the latest news from around the world and from our friends and family on social media. Recently, there seems to be something of a negative reaction to the pervasiveness of technology in our lives. Many of us are now questioning if technology is actually good for us. Does technology ultimately lend us tools for good? What are some of the ways that technology is being used for good? Ashton Kutcher, actor turned tech investor and enthusiast, came to Dreamforce 17 to talk about Thorn, a company he co-founded in 2009. Thorn drives technology innovation to fight trafficking and the sexual exploitation of children and adults. Thorn partners across the tech industry, government, and NGOs, leveraging technology to combat predatory behavior, accelerate victim identification, and protect vulnerable children. Take a listen to how Kutcher is using tech for good.
I was asked to come here today to talk about technology as a force for good. But I don't think I can do that because I don't believe it to be true. I don't think that technology is any more a force for good than it is a force for evil. People like to give technology credit for all kinds of things. Look at all this good it's creating. Look at all that it's building. Look at the diseases that it's solving. And then they also like to blame it. We've become a nation, we've become a world of blame and victimization. And now we're blaming technology because we don't want to point the finger at each other. But technology, that's the radicalization of terrorism. That's technology's fault. The proliferation of child pornography, that's technology's fault. Even the political climate. I mean, we're at each other's throat, but that's social media. That's technology's fault. We like to blame technology. But technology isn't a force for good or a force for evil. It's just a tool. It's an extraordinary tool. Don't get me wrong. It allows us to do super high targeted focus on whatever it is that we're working on. It allows us to collect data and actually evidence around what it is that we need to do. It allows us to exact and multiply our effects in the world in extraordinary ways. It allows us and has changed the way that we see time, space, and motion because of the efficiencies that it creates. But it is not the force for good or the force for evil. That's you. You are the force for good or the force for evil. When a carpenter builds a house, if they build a house that stands for 100, 1,000 years, nobody gives credit to the hammer. If that same house were to fall in 3 days, no one would blame the hammer. It's just a tool. You are the force for good. And the only question that we have to ask ourselves is, how good are we? How good are you? What are you willing to sacrifice in your life? What convenience are you willing to give up in order to create the good that you want to see in the world? And is there a problem in the world that you see, that you may have had no part in creating, that you want to be responsible for? I was confronted with this question. I confronted myself with this question. Because I look at the good fortune I have in my life and I thought, I have to do something. And then I saw a Dateline special. And there were these young children in Cambodia, 4, 5, 6, 7, being raped by tourists for profit. I thought, this is only happening in this third world. This can't be happening here. This is crazy. And then I decided, let me just scratch beneath the surface. And I found this. 75 million unique searches for child pornography in the United States. 75 million. And this is just the United States. It's a giant problem. There are 150,000 ads that are posted on the internet every single day trying to sell a human for sex. Many of those are children. There are millions of images that are transferred daily of child abuse material. And it's daunting. And you look at it and you go, And I thought to myself, do I want to be that guy that shows up at the accident and I've got my cell phone and I'm recording it as it happens? Or am I the guy that puts down the damn cell phone and goes and helps the people that are hurting? I want to be the person that puts down the phone. I want to be the person that steps up and goes, I don't know what I can do. I'm an actor. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to do something. And so I decided to do that. And what I found was, as we investigated further, there were many sick people. And they're sick, make no mistake. I don't think anyone's pure evil, but there are sick people in the world that are the force for evil. And they're equipped with extraordinary technology and they're really, really smart about how they do what they do. And they leverage this tool as a force for evil. And on the other side of the equation, there were these extraordinary people, good people, the force for good, but they just didn't have the tool to fight back. And so I found some more good people. And when I'm saying there were a lot of people, there are 30 companies that have helped us on this, over 315 engineers, 5,000 law enforcement officials, all standing on the sidelines using arcane tools to do a really big job. So I found this group of people, and I said, do you want to be a force for good? And they made the sacrifice. They all could go out and get some high-paying job doing some extraordinary thing. They all could get the accolades every day, all day, because they're that good. And I said, do you think we could build a tool that this force for good could use? And so we built a tool. And we built another tool. And we built another tool. And the numbers that were quoted have since been updated. We've identified 6,000 children that are being abused. We've identified 12,000 adults that are also being abused, and 6,000 abusers. We're operating in 19 countries with 5,000 law enforcement officials using the tool and 21,000 investigations, and it's working. We deployed the tool to the people that were the force for good, and they're making it happen. And I only stand here because of them. I only stand here because of you.
Technology is rapidly changing our future. One of the ways is through the technology users of tomorrow. The Girl Scouts of America are looking ahead to utilize digital tools for their young members around the country. Sylvia Acevedo, CEO of Girl Scouts of America, touches on how the organization is empowering young girls to become technology super users and to use tech to become the change makers of tomorrow. Let's listen in on her conversation at Dreamforce with Alan Murray, president of Fortune.
Technology is going to continue to impact everything around us, all the devices that we interact with. And we at Girl Scouts want our girls to not just be users of technology, but we actually want them to be technology literate. We want them to be the creators, the designers, the inventors of new technology. Now, that means for our organization, we've got to be much more nimble. We're really grateful for our partnership with Salesforce that allows us a common operating model. But we have Girl Scouts in every residential zip code. We have Girl Scouts that are in urban, suburban, rural environments. We need to make sure that we've got the digital tools that they're used to working with so that we can provide the services that they're expecting.
So you see big changes ahead for the way the Girl Scouts operates?
You know, we really do see that we will never get away from our in-person outdoor experiences, but yes, we do have to include much more technology in everything that we do. And really, it's pretty exciting because that's really where the girls are. That's where their moms are. Everyone connects, creates, you know, collaborates using their mobile devices, and we need to be there. And, you know, we realize that we have to be part of the solution. All across America, CEOs say to me, we need more women in STEM. And yesterday, I was really pleased to announce our Girl Scout STEM pledge, where we will add 2.5 million more girls into the STEM pipeline. That's absolutely necessary for our country, companies, to be competitive. And we at Girl Scouts, we're girl experts, so we know how to make that a really great experience for them. So we're really excited about what's ahead of us in technology.
Next time on Blazing Trails, we'll be jumping into the world of artificial intelligence. AI is ever-changing, and we will be exploring all the multitude of ways that AI is changing our daily lives as we know them. Don't miss this important and thoughtful look at all things AI. Thank you again for joining us on Blazing Trails. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and keep up with exclusive content from trailblazers around the world.